My mother was dragging me out of the gym theater on State Street in Salt Lake while I resisted, leaning back, pulling back, crying, screaming, "I want to go back, I want to see it again." The movie was Walt Disney's Dumbo. And something about it affected me profoundly. Maybe it was the intense mother-son attraction or attachment. I was almost unhealthily bonded with my mother. In fact, it took me years into my marriage to completely shed the mama's boy thing. And Dumbo just goes crazy when he's apart from his mother. Or maybe Dumbo affected me so significantly because I could actually see the movie. The vivid, sharply contrasting colors came through my seriously myopic eyes and actually let me see as well as hear the story. I was severely nearsighted. Most movies didn't get to me because I couldn't see them. I got more than one spanking because I couldn't sit through the moving blur of images that made no sense to me. I remember particularly the blur and the whipping of Sergeant York at the Center Theater. Or maybe my youngest daughter suggests Dumbo didn't really grow up until he encounters black culture. The funny jive-talking, utterly cool black crows. My first inkling of the influence of African-American culture on popular culture, I don't know. But few of my memories are so vivid as that, being dragged out of the gym theater so I couldn't see Dumbo again. But I'm in the 50s. When I first heard it on the radio, I was stunned. I listened to the radio a lot in those days, the early 50s, and I kept close track of the popular songs of the day and who was singing them. I loved Frankie Lane and Patti Page and the Mills Brothers and K-Star and the Four Aces and Nat King Cole and, well, most of the popular singers. I even kept my own top 10 lists. But when I first heard this burst out of the radio, I knew this was somehow different. This singer's voice penetrated right through to my emerging passion-fueled center. It was 1951, and I was 14, and the singer was Johnny Ray, and the song was Cry. And I shivered and almost shed tears each time I heard it on the radio. So as soon as I could, I got the Van Berger train from where I lived in Kaysville and got to Salt Lake and walked the block and a half to ZCMI without even going into the listening booths. I bought the record and I carried it reverently home. And I played it endlessly for weeks. The first side was Cry and the B-side was The Little White Cloud That Cried. I played them both, alternating. I made my girlfriend, Mary Ann, sit with me and listen over and over. And the impact sustained itself for weeks, with me at least, way past the time Johnny Ray appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and stood like a coiled snake, grabbing great clumps of air with his out-of-control hands. As I look back, I doubt Mary Ann was similarly affected, but she was pliant and she seemed not to get bored too easily, and well, she was my early 50s girlfriend. Now, these songs were hardly masterworks, lyrically or musically. Cry was a weeper of remarkable ordinariness. If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, you'll feel better if you sit right down and cry. And so on. And The Little White Cloud That Cried, which was written by Johnny Ray himself, was just, well, strange. A musical tale of a young man who walks down by a river feeling very sad inside, and he strikes up a conversation with this lonely little white cloud who tells him that sometimes the thunder and lightning make all the little clouds hide. But the little white cloud tells the lonely boy to have faith in all kinds of weather, for the sun will always shine. The dark clouds pass with time. Yes, no matter how strange a context, I needed to hear that at 14. Rather, I needed to feel that. And there were things lurking in Johnny Ray, and those songs, first of all, it had to be that voice, undisciplined, ragged, penetrating, full of loneliness, full of anguish, coming from some place I understood very well. I later found that Johnny Ray had had a miserable adolescence. He was skinny and maladroit and half deaf, and he walked and talked like a girl. And yes, he was homosexual, gay. Now, I didn't really know what that meant in the early 50s, being gay, but his voice told me he was still lonely and anguished. I suppose all adolescents feel themselves to be lonely, way down deep inside anyway. I sure did. Something else else I found out later is that Johnny Ray had grown up listening to Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday and Count Basie and other black performers, and that he played the piano with considerable skill, and that he had matured his style at Detroit's Flame Club, which was virtually all black venue in which he alternated singing days with Billie Holiday and other good to great black performers. I also found out later that some bigwig at Columbia Records early on said Johnny Ray sounded like a Negro woman, so they released Cry and Little White Cloud to Cry at first on OK Records, Columbia's race label. His biographer makes a convincing claim that Johnny Ray was an important bridge from black music to rock and roll, and Jerry Lee Lewis wasn't the first singer to kick the piano bench across the stage. Another adolescent who was deeply affected by Johnny Ray was Bob Dylan, when he was still Bobby Zimmerman, a lonely middle class kid from northern Minnesota. And this time, the popular culture told me not a reinforcing myth about my bond with my mother. It was the beginning of the end of that bond. It gave me the first feeling I had that I was a different person from my parents. I had a music, my own music, not my mother's Bing Crosby and Tabernacle Choir record, but my very own teenage music. In fact, the 50s were the beginnings of a whole teenage culture, not only mine, kids all over the country. Kids with disposable income out there as a market. It may have been the decade when teenagers were first thought of as a separate category of human beings, adults and children. We certainly began to have that manifested in the teen music in the 50s. So while music filled my ears and swirled around in my head, what I really grew up on was the movies. Those sublimely invasive images structured the way I saw the world. Images of possibility, images of romance, images of exotic places, images of deep yearning and pain, and images of larger-than-life characters I began to internalize, and the stories, the myths, told in this profoundly moving way. First after Dumbo, my movie passions were Saturday afternoon serials and B-Westerns, Gene Autry, Hopalong Cassidy, Wild Bill Elliott. Every Saturday afternoon, I'd take the Bamberger train from Kaysville to Layton and meet my friend Wesley Sykes, and we'd go downtown and buy popcorn and a big hunk and go to the movies. And after the movies, we'd act out our fantasies as Western heroes. There were, although my parents, passions were these B-Westerns and Abbott and Costello. But after these silly comedies and slapdash Westerns faded for me, it was all sorts of movies. There were still Westerns, but in my early teens, it was High Noon and Shane, The Gunfighter, and My Darling Clementine. And war movies like Operation Pacific and The Sands of Iwo Jima. Film noir like The Big Heat and The Post of Always Rings Twice. Romances like The African Queen and The Quiet Man. Musicals like Showboat and Singing in the Rain. Spectacles like The Ten Commandments and Quo Vadis. I still get aroused by the image of Deckard Carr in a diaphanous negligee, tied to a post in the center of the Roman Colosseum, waiting heroically for the lions to test her Christian faith and the gravity-defying nature of her apparel. And there was The Conqueror on most people's list of all-time worst movies. It starred John Wayne as Genghis Khan or something like that, and Susan Hayward in her 50s prom dress as his paramour. And it was filmed in Snow Canyon north of St. George. And half the cast and crew died of cancer. Much of it brought on the from the nuclear test in Nevada, and I wrote a play about it a few years ago. And there were, of course, frequently re-released before my time classics, such as Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz. These and all the other movies that I saw shape the inside of my head and determine how my eyes saw the world. In the characters, I saw models of behavior. Fonda, John Wayne, Gary Cooper, Glenn Ford, Clark Gable, images that told me what makes a man, and what makes desirable girls and women, Judy Garland, Maureen O'Hara, Jennifer Jones, Grace Kelly, I think I couldn't look at a real girl in my beginning without referencing some images I'd seen on the screen. I thought my high school sweetheart looked like some mix of Jean Peters and Jennifer Jones. But something different, something special happened in the mid-50s. Some tectonic shift in the movie images that obsessed me. My first stirring was prompted by Marlon Brando. Something dangerous lurked there, something exotic. An actor that let out through his verbal and physical language all sorts of subterranean emotions, lusts and fears and pain. But this new thing presaged by Brando really erupted into my emotional life in 1955. My girlfriend Marianne and I went to the Center Theater in Salt Lake to see Idia Kazan's movie version of John Steinbeck's East of Eden, and I was never quite the same again. Mostly because of the shattering performance by James Dean, projecting things I'd only vaguely felt, trying with great fervor to come to terms with his mother and father. Struggling to become an adult, maybe the first movie filmed from the point of view of a teenager. But my mother was certainly not a madam running a brothel, but she was a disturbed woman I watched descend into madness. And my father was no hard-ass Raymond Massey, but we didn't communicate well. Virtually none of his ardent pursuits really interested me, no matter how he and I lived. Johnny Ray and James Dean were my first rock and roll. I grew up in Caseville, and its primary economic engines were growing fruit, mom-and-pop businesses, and Mod Sanders Global Club potato chips. The primary cultural engine was the Mormon Church. Well over 90% of the town was LDS. We went to Sunday school and priesthood meeting and sacrament meeting on Sundays, MIA and Boy Scouts on Tuesdays, with other word events sprinkled liberally through the week. Lots of word dances and dinners and sports and road shows. We started dating young. I was 14 and Marianne was 12 when we first sat together in church or lounged together chastely holding hands on one of our front lawns, gazing at the then brilliant stars and contemplating Kolob. 14 and 12 when we walked our first walk down Center Street to the Caseville Theater to see whatever was playing. Holding hands through the movie, didn't matter how much what movie, I saw them all two or three times. And Marianne was in the same ward. We went to half a block down the street. Now, as I remember it, adults, parents, didn't pay undue attention to what their young teenagers did with their time in the 50s. There weren't all of these activities, soccer, dance, and music lessons, at least not that parents had to drive us to. So we had a lot more discretionary time on our hands. And most parents I knew figured that we'd been brought up right, and they trusted us. But when you put a boy and girl together, there will be effects. Especially if they're both blossoming into puberty. But there were strict limits we in the culture set. Nothing past first base. But even as I was as passionate about movies as I was about girls, by my mid-teen, I was taking the Bamberger to Salt Lake on Saturdays when I could break loose and wander the streets and stores and see movies at the Uptown, the Utah, the Larry, the Gym, the Center, and the Studio, the big seats. One Saturday, I saw movies at five different theaters. The combination of the big city and the movies not only expanded the dreams in my head, but gave them a physical reality. I loved Salt Lake. It was mind-expanding. Glimmers of hope for my life beyond my vaguely unsatisfying growing up in Caseville. The 50s have to be the era in which middle-class American values and tastes and LDS values and tastes were most congruent. We all listened to the same pop music. We saw the same movies. We watched the same television shows. Everybody listened to Eddie Fisher and Perry Como and Patti Page. We all saw High Noon and the Ten Commandments. Magnificent Obsession, we all watched Ed Sullivan and Sid Caesar and I Love Lucy. We danced the same dances, the waltz, the two-step, the Salt Lake drag, which was undoubtedly also the Omaha drag, the Miami drag, and the Fresno drag. We all had the same assumptions about sexual mores. We were all assumed that these singers and those actors had the same buttoned-up puritanical attitudes toward sex that we did. Didn't we? We assumed the same things. I mean, how could you look at Grace Kelly and not assume she was pure and virginal just like the beautiful girl? girl I dated at BYU. And how could those 30-somethings Doris Day and Rock Hudson not be saving themselves for each other? I was asked, as I was, you look like you just got out of bed, you okay? We go back to the 50s.
Oh.
As I was surfing past the BYU channel a few weeks ago, a nicely done up middle-aged woman caught my eye, or rather my ear. I didn't get the context at first, but she was talking about some young man putting his hand on some young girl's knee. The woman seemed to indicate this in itself as questionable behavior. But it seemed to indicate, but it became totally unacceptable when the young man put his thumb under the girl's knee. Now this interested me because the most intimate touching Marianne and I ever did was for me to put my hand on her knee under her skirt. But beyond that, it surely occurred to me to do so, but I do know, as well as I can remember, that I never, ever put my thumb under her knee. So anyway, I kept watching this woman on the BYU channel to find out more about her take on this knee business. The woman with beautifully coiffed hair was at a podium speaking forcefully to her audience. As I checked the title of her presentation and as I saw the screen behind her, I realized that under the banner Families Under Fire, she was doing a PowerPoint presentation on helping adolescents choose abstinence. Now, she really had my attention, and I was somehow relevant in this to this presentation I was working on. It took me back to Firesides of Yore, something my sister tells me still goes on. Except in my Firesides in the 50s, nobody would have thought of even whispering anything about sex. Now I was watching a well-organized disquisition by a woman, no less. What this nicely dressed woman had done was divide relationships between young men and young women into three stages. Stage one was something she called casual friendship. Stage two was the beginnings of commitment to one other person. And stage three was intimate commitment or something like that. My phone rang before I got to listen to stage three. But the woman was saying something very sensible. She was saying that there is too much emphasis in the church on what one ought not to do physically. Setting limits to where one hands might wander. Rather, she said, what is more important is setting emotional limits. If you don't allow yourself to get emotionally charged enough to want to put your thumb under a young woman's knee, you won't be tempted to do that. You should emotionally close your horses, as Frank Sinatra was saying, and indeed take it nice and easy. Nice and easy until the marriage ceremony. In the 50s, until I was married in 1961, I did indeed hold my horses. And there weren't really pop culture inducements not to, at least that my brain could process. And I recall as I thought about it, this woman on the BYU network really, in her heart of hearts, wished that she lived in 1955. A time before there was blatant sexuality in popular music and in television and movies. A time when teenagers had an ingrown sense of emotional as well as physical limits. It is important, and it's a central way, that something that hasn't changed for thousands of years, whether it be the 50s or the aughts, we're all programmed biologically when we become adolescents to search for and find a mate. And part of this biological mechanism, we as adolescents all of a sudden have a heightened awareness of people and things around us, of music, of visual images, of verbal chatter. We're moved by the places of these years' heightened awareness. I remember soft summer nights, so quiet the crickets seemed loud, walking hand in hand with a girl lying in the lush grass, touching each other mostly innocently, the smell of a Utah night, the sound of a distant train, and the cars, big handsome cars, all shined up. Powerful cars, beautiful cars, and Larry Awards, cars with bench seats in both front and back. Plenty of room to kiss a neck. I went to see Mary Ann, my childhood sweetheart, 10 years ago. She'd written me a Dear John letter 9 months into my mission and married a fellow who went on to teach at BYU, and they lived in Provo pretty much their whole lives together. And she had 4 sons. We reminisced, and it was mostly quite pleasant. It's true we no longer had much in common except some remnants of that special charge one has with one's first sweetheart. I commented late on that I'd always figured growing up that I was a pretty normal Mormon kid. She paused, looked at me, and looked and said, "Are you kidding?" And she said, she never thought that. But she didn't elaborate, and I didn't push her, but did explain a lot about why she dumped me twice. For which, that night, we were both very grateful. Earlier this summer, I took my 12-year-old granddaughter, Leah, to New York for her first experience with my favorite big city. We were there a week and had a marvelous time. Leah, because one's first experience with New York is always amazing, a little staggering. And then my marvelous time came through seeing a place I love through someone else's eyes, someone I love. I asked her before we went where she'd like to go. The first thing she said was Ground Zero. Then she asked if New York had good museums. I told her she wouldn't be disappointed. But the big event in Leah's mind, central to our trip, was to see a performance of the musical Wicked, songs from which she'd been singing for years. We went to museums. I took her to an off-Broadway production of La Mama, legendary La Mama of King Lear, New York City Ballet. We did go to Ground Zero, Statue of Liberty, and we walked Greenwich Village and Lower East Side, and Upper West Side, and Upper East Side, and Chelsea. We went to F.A.O. Schwartz, the posh shops on Fifth Avenue, found the Dean and DeLuca's, and bought all kinds of wonderful treats. Because I had this presentation in mind, I paid particular attention to what kind of pop culture experience Leah was tuned into. I tried to talk music with her back in her Avril Lavigne period, but her taste seemed to change so fast and I was so unhip to her music, not much came of that. But I did look at what she was reading during the trip. Before we got back home to Sacramento, Leah had consumed 4 and was working on the 5th book in a series called Gossip Girl. My interest was increased as we walked out of the Metropolitan Museum. She stood for a few moments on the front steps looking across the street. I paused with her, tried to see what she was looking at. Then she said, "The girls in my books live over there." She was looking at probably the most expensive residential real estate in the country. So as we walked down Fifth Avenue, we speculated. I talked to her about maybe what some of those apartments cost. I read recently that some of the people I knew lived there. When we got home, I had a look at her latest book, Gossip Girl book, which on the back quoted Teen People as and describing the series as Sex in the City for the younger set. Now there were 16-year-old girls drinking from negligent parents' liquor cabinet, teen girls talking a lot about sex, teens even having sex. When I asked Leah how she got into these books, she said their 13-year-old friend Colby told her about them. When I asked a friend of mine who knows young people's literature about this, she said that even though the books were about 16-year-olds, these so-called teen novels were totally directed at 12 and 13-year-olds. Leah and her friend Colby were the target audience. When I was 12, I was reading Captain Marvel and the Hardy Boys. I started speculating about what effect these grown-up books and all the movies and television and the internet, with all the easy access to sexual images, might affect young people, particularly Leah. But I recall a favorite nephew of mine and a friend of his as they stopped in the mid-90s at our home in Indiana. They parked their ancient Volkswagen bus outside on the street and came in to talk and commute and spend the night. My nephew had very long hair, a strong counterculture vibe, and lots of illegal substances stashed in the van. They were on their way to join the Grateful Dead tour. They were deadheads. Now, I know that drugs and alcohol have been a part of my nephew's life pretty much since he was in junior high school. What on earth was going to happen to him? Well, my nephew is now a practicing attorney with a wife and three kids, and he is, with his family, almost obsessively active in the church. I did take Leah to a production of a play I directed 20 years before called Spring Awakening. It was a new rock version, and the play is about 14, 15-year-old young people discovering sex. Now, I'd done in 1986 a pretty, as I watched this first 15 minutes of this version, a pretty tasteful version, but when the character, and it looked fascinating, I'd love to have seen it, and the music was pretty good, it was rock music, and, except when the characters, actors started simulating masturbation on stage, for my second row seat, I took Leah's hand and I edged my way out of the theater, the 50s coming out in Grandpa. I don't know how Leah will turn out, but her parents are raising her and her sister with great care and attention. They aren't particularly concerned with keeping her away from pop culture, but they do see she's exposed to the arts beyond that and to cultural experiences and travel that gives her a larger picture of what culture is and what her life is and what she might become. As for religion, they do go to a liberal Methodist church with a woman pastor. Their other grandfather is a Catholic turned Quaker turned Unitarian. Their other grandmother is a Catholic turned Quaker turned practicing Buddhist. And they hear a lot about their mothers growing up Mormon, and they know about my obsessive wrestling with Mormonism. But now Leah's older sister Eden does competitive fencing and just spent 3 weeks in Honduras helping poor people build houses. Leah will be fine. Now, if this were a 50s movie, I could sum up what pop culture not only could do, but what it ought to do. There'd be some come-to-realize ending. If you behave this way, this will be the outcome. My mother believed that, and she was very careful to make sure I got the message that what I shaped myself to be in my youth, that's what I'd be when I was grown up. And a scripture that at first comforted her was, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, will not depart from it. It comforted my mother until I grew up. And it didn't turn out the way she planned. Caused her much pain, and in the last 15 years of her life, the demonic forces that had plagued her all her life focused themselves on what a disappointment I'd become. But I think more to the point, what a bad mother she'd been to allow such an outcome. For over 25 years, I was a straight arrow young Latter-day Saint, went to BYU, I did my mission. I married a young woman from an old and distinguished Mormon family, and I married her in the temple. My mother did later on begin to blame my wife. Her sweet little boy could really have gone so wrong all on his own. The aftermath of all those testosterone-fueled adolescent mating years is supposed to consist of settling down and raising a family and letting all that adolescent juice settle into a ready, God-sanctioned outlet and a life of blissful and serviceable routine. A big part of that consists on learning and then practicing a respectable profession. I thought about becoming a psychiatrist, and my models in town were high school teachers. I thought maybe I could become a high school teacher. My dad had friends, one of whom was the county attorney, one of whom ran a bank. After my mission, my the mission president called me in just before I went home, advising me to go to Harvard Business School, make lots of money, and serve the church, maybe even be a general employee. I did think briefly about business school or law school. Within 3 days of my return to BYU, I auditioned for my first play. I somehow made my decision, I cast my lot, I made this commitment to my future. The poet Rilke wrote, "Art is childhood, after all. Art means to be oblivious to the fact that the world already exists, and to create one. Not to destroy what one encounters, but simply not to find anything complete. Countless possibilities." I chose to remain, in Rilke's terms, in childhood. I chose to create worlds rather than inhabit already made old ones, however inferior they might be. And didn't I hear in Sunday school way back that this life is meant to prepare us to create worlds throughout eternity? Well, I decided to keep majoring in drama and theater. But something started to happen, something more than playing began to take hold of me. I read plays such as Long Day's Journey into Night, The Divic, His Pity, She's a Whore, Danton's Death, Waiting for Godot, and these plays, to me, were more powerful than scripture. I knew at that point in my life I was attracted to darker things, explorations of what sickened, depraved, and ruinous, and how we deal with that. So I started to feel my way towards a profession. And there was this theater professor at BYU, only 10 years older than me, and I caught for the first time a vision of a profession. Maybe I could do what he did. He does theater, he's solid in the church, and he's married, and has 4 kids. Maybe I could do that. Now before I go any farther, I ought to define what I mean by erotics. Sure, it's that perpetual erection in the backseat of an early 50s Studebaker. And it's that deep-rooted and passionate need for connection to another human being. It's a state in which Proust says, one pays no attention to anything that does not connect with the real life of the woman one loves. Erotics is about this obsessive, all-consuming craving we have for the object of our craving, sometimes to the point of jealousy and madness. But also by erotics, I mean the larger impulse toward what Freud calls the pleasure principle. When one is in an erotic mode, one is seeking outside oneself for enlightenment, for enrichment, for knowledge, for sensation. The impulse that connects us to others, others unlike ourselves, the impulse toward life, the passionate urge to create and complete a world for ourselves. By living in an erotic mode, one is not stuck numbly in the reality principle in which we define our life by our death. I grew up terrified that any rebellion, erotic or otherwise, would have negative consequences in the hereafter. That God was always watching me, judging me, disappointed in me, this great wash of perpetual guilt. One of the most powerful and most insidious hold religion have over either people is a control of their sexual or erotic lives. As an adolescent, I certainly was consumed with erotic obsessions about girls. I recently found among my Kaysville memorabilia an outsized postcard. It was a hand-colored photograph of Old Faithful in full eruption. On the back, written in pencil, were the names of over half a dozen girls, some of them written as many as 3 times. Girls I'd had crushes on in junior high. I listed them in chronological order, including how many weeks or months I'd fixated on them. It was Charlotte Edwards and Mary Ray Marcus and Connie Allen and Mary Thorderson and others. Mary Ann was mixed in there too. Clearly I was a floating erotic obsession looking for some place to land. But after my mission, it was time to find a mate and a profession and settle in. In my later dating years, I seriously considered marrying 4 young women who also seemed to want to marry me. Very different types of women. All 3 of the women I might have married area that didn't, now live in Utah County, and as far as I know, very active in the church. The other one I did marry, Diana Markham. When Diana died in 1961, the local paper called the interview before for an article about her, because she was very prominent in the town. And I told her the young woman that she descended from Mormon royalty, and she had seen Markham was just as his money, and I told her that I was descended from the horse thieves, which she printed in the paper, which I read to relatives in sermons. The relatives didn't seem to mind the Stuarts and the Atleys. We'd always consider ourselves a little outside the pale. Diana Markham was nothing like my mother, thank goodness. She was this bright, beautiful, curious, funny girl who grew up in Provo and was set to do anything to get out. Her parents, sensing trouble when she wanted to go away to college, told her they'd buy her a car if she went to BYU. Her father had by that time designed about half the buildings on campus, so he had some. And his close friend was Ernest Wilkinson. Her parents, sensing trouble when she wanted to go away to college, told her they'd buy her a car if she went to BYU. She promptly went out and bought a turquoise 1956 Chevy Bel Air convertible with a wonderful bench of seats. Then enrolled at BYU. A big reason she married me, I knew, was that she knew I was going to take her over a lot of state lines. Also, as a instinct that whatever physical and emotional trials we might have to endure, there's something at the core that binds us. When we started out, I didn't realize I'd marry a closet rebel, a closet maverick. I don't have time to list all the ways Diana, 50s popular culture influenced Diana, but the influences were deep and lasting. Her singers were Johnny Mathis and Ella Fitzgerald, and she liked to go to movies alone too. Her model for looks and behavior was Grace Kelly. Recently, a friend who lived next door to my wife and me the first year of our marriage said his impression was that what Diana and I did mostly was fight. And as I look back, I realize that's pretty much what we did. Not all the time, but fight we did. And also, as I look back, I realize it was a battle of two strong-willed people to claim their own space in this marriage. A marriage that began in 1961, just as we entered the 60s. We stayed fascinated by popular culture, and we were swept away by the increasing connection between such culture and politics. We were in the early stages of being radicalized by the mid-60s. I voted for Nixon in 1960, Johnson in 1964. We bought our first Bob Dylan album in 1965. And perhaps ironically, the more Diana and I got caught up in the 60s, the better our marriage became. And we took considerable joy in finding our own cultural and political feet away from strong pressures to conform. Diana's father had been a Hoover delegate from Utah in the 1932 Republican convention. And in 1968, one of her brothers had George Wallace literature on his coffee table, or post-it table. Diana wrote children's books and romance novels for, in the 70s we both began to make popular culture. Diana wrote children's books and romantic novels, romance novels for Silhouette, and wrote and directed a series of original cabarets based in the American popular songbook. I started writing westerns and mysteries and plays. Our marriage lasted 40 years and kept us interested in finding new things about each other right to the end. Marriage that unleashed a passionate curiosity in both of us. God bless me beyond my deserving by giving me Diana. Before I finish this up, I want to go back to Leah and our trip to the Yalta. I paid more money than I want to think about to secure front and center tickets for Wicked. As most of you know, Wicked is a musical deconstruction of the original book and movie, The Wizard of Oz, and it's great fun and full of references to the original. I've, of course, seen the 30s movie many times, as have Leah. And I think every 50s kid took a kind of reassurance from the archetypal story of an adolescent being forced away from home and returning to that home full of wondrous images from a strange and foreign land. Wicked assumes that story that takes as its main characters Glinda the Good Witch and Elphaba the Wicked Witch of the West, who happens to be green. The story turns expectations, the backstories of the witches, into a chance for great reversals of our expectations and great fun and some moral lessons, things that wouldn't have occurred to us in the 50s. In the plot, Glinda and Elphaba become friends in their school long before Dorothy, called that whiny little farm girl, falls into their midst. Glinda is portrayed as a not-too-bright blonde, and Elphaba is a smart and self-aware young woman who must endure the social stigma of being bright green. What fascinated me about this musical, I thought about Leah Wasserman, was that she was getting the original Oz story on a lot more levels than I ever did. She was being encouraged to think about what it means to be green or different in a world full of people who are none like you, a little less than prejudice. And the political system of Oz is shown in Wicked to be corrupt, not just goofy, a little less than being wary of politicians. And Wicked presents Leah with a pretty dark view of the world and gets her immersed much more deeply into that than just the scary flying monkeys in the original movie. And maybe most important, Leah gets something of a lesson in irony. Not everything is as it seems. You can't totally trust the surface of things. There are always levels to any story or myth. Leah has to have some sense of irony to love this musical. And that's why I think kids have now, what I didn't have during my growing up, an encouragement to look behind and beneath the surface of things. And I think that's just what saves good kids now from being swept away by the great rush of popular culture that could overwhelm them. As I said, Leah will be fine. She already has a richer eternal life than I did at her age, and she was has much more and better tools to evaluate her experiences. And I do believe a 12-year-old will understand only what a 12-year-old is capable of understanding. And that understanding is both far simpler and far more complex than the adults attempting to transfer their own responses to a 12-year-old, to a 12-year-old mind. Now there may be pockets of Latter-day Saints along the Idaho, Arizona, Utah, Mormon corridor in which young people are totally shielded from the almost ubiquitous pop culture. But for the most part, it's impossible to keep kids from connecting to it. There are just too many avenues. But there is also the question, should they be protected from the culture at large? I have good Orthodox relatives who were sheltered from popular culture and have thrived in their Mormonism. I also have relatives who were sheltered from popular culture and seem to just curl up and go dry without any curiosity in the world. I know LDS kids who liberally took of the total culture and living milieu and are still strong members of the faith. I've known kids whose encounters with pop culture help push them away from the church. There's no simple formula. My choice and my wife's choice was to try and provide a home atmosphere in which our kids' exposure to popular culture is part of a richer, far more complex understanding of the world, where the family business was, after all, theater. As for the proliferation of pornography in our culture, you and I all know that generations of adolescents before pornography was readily accessible and made passionate use of the Sears catalog. I had my hidden copy of Mickey's Play Inside the Jury. Diana read and reread parts of Not as a Stranger. It really doesn't take much. I was talking to my younger daughter the other day about about this topic, and we talk a lot about the church and the Mormon culture and how important it is to her, but concerning her pretty much leaving the church, she said, "I just had too much curiosity." I think that finally that there are three things that began in the 50s that guided me through life to a pretty good sense of what gives me comfort, spiritual supper, and a feeling of achievement. First, a sense of curiosity. Joseph Smith was maybe the most curious man I've ever read about. He'd think anything, try anything, absorb anything he could from the culture around him. Absorbed it hungrily. Didn't recognize that tune. The second is an attraction to the darker things, which I've had to understand so I could better understand the light. I think of Leonard Cohen's line, "There is a crack in everything."